So we are gathered here, many of you on the meditation retreat, and in the style of the Thai forest tradition, then we gather together to listen to Dhamma and to meditate along with it. So having Dhamma talks is a, you could say, a big part of this Thai forest tradition. In the Ajahn Chah Memorial every January. Maybe many of you have been on the night of the 16th January, then at about after evening chanting, about 9 p.m., then the Dhamma talks will begin. And so they will start from then. Maybe each monk might give an hour talk, and then gradually, the monks, after the first few monks, then they'd give about a half an hour talk. And so all the way till morning, till 5 a.m. for, I think there's no morning chanting on the 17th, but all talks all night like this. And so this is a very big part of the Ajahn Chah tradition. And so on one of these years, I'd been asked to give a Dhamma talk. And so I gave a talk, and because I was quite junior at that time, my talk was maybe, I don't know, 17th along the line. And that was about maybe 2:30 a.m. By the time I would give my half an hour talk. And so I gave this talk, and I think it was okay. And then after me, there was another Western monk from Wat Mapchan as well. And he got up to give his talk. And so he gave his talk in Thai, and it was he was doing his best to give the Dhamma as best he could. And then after about maybe 20 minutes, he's starting to slow down and slow down, and then he stops altogether. And then by this time it was maybe almost 3 a.m. and people were, it's a hall full of people, but because they'd been listening all night, as usual, then there's going to be those who are very tired and nodding off while they're listening to the Dhamma. And so they're nodding off. And after he pauses or stops for about 30 seconds, which is a very long time if you're giving a Dhamma talk of just silence. And by then, now the people who are nodding off start to kind of wake up and look at what's going on. Why is there no one speaking? And some of the people as well who were closed their eyes meditating had opened their eyes and wondering what's going on. And even the monks as well had wondered what's going to happen. I was wondering. And by another 30 seconds after that, which was so a minute had passed, and then I was hoping, oh, why doesn't the MC, which was at that time Lumpur Somchai from Wat Mapchan, he had the mic there as well if you want to say anything, but he was silent as well. And you could, or I could anyway, feel my own mind just wanting to hear something. The mind starts to scream out of, give me any sound, someone say something, if it's the MC or him, the speaker. And no one said anything for another minute even. So 2 minutes had passed with no one saying anything, just complete silence. And by then everyone was awake, you could say. And then the monk starts talking again. And he says, when I first got interested in Buddhism was when I saw a documentary of Venerable Ajahn Chah. And in it, the interviewer asked, what's the highest thing? And he thought to himself that, oh, that's a hard question to answer. And Ajahn Chah answered it very simply. Let go, letting go. And the monk said he was very impressed at the answer, And he said, when I am like this, not able to say anything, and I want to give a good talk and I can't, well, I have to just let go. And for you as well, when you want to, hear a good talk, you also have to let go. And then he asks the audience, oh, what do you, so you understand? And then people were raising up their hands like, oh yeah, letting go. As if that was the most profound, you could say, talk or Dhamma that they had received the whole night. And I'm pretty sure that every talk before that, the 15, 16, 17 talks before that, had all talked about letting go, Bloy Wang. But it was this one that really was memorable, was impressive. And my, I'd say, feeling on it is it's because this mind of ours, it sort of consumes our senses. And so even maybe sitting in a Dhamma talk and you're used to the sound of this voice, sound of the speaker, and that's something you consume as well. And if it's, and in that case, when it was taken away, that sound, the mind was like almost hungry or almost suffering, even wishing for any sound. And that's the maybe nature of the mind. And also another point is that if there is very good, strong intention that we create every time we're listening to a Dhamma talk, then it can produce very good results. Sometimes maybe we can listen to Dhamma talks and it's, we're hearing maybe similar themes a lot. But every talk we should maybe establish our intention anew that, this Dhamma can lead me or help me to become free from suffering. This is why I'm listening to the Dhamma. It's that profound. If I can understand it deeply, then I'll develop my mind and can even lead all the way up to understanding the Dhamma, to attainment to the Dhamma. So setting that intention up anew every time is helpful for us. And today was going to talk, I'm going to talk a bit more about this sort of perception and feelings. And the reason I want to talk about that is if we look in terms of the dependent origination of Paticca-samuppada, we may have read it and looked at it, and we see avijja, ignorance, then conditions, sankhara. This sankhara may be translated into different ways, but there's the body, speech, and the mind aspect of that sankhara. And these perceptions and feelings that we have, these condition our mind states. So literally are conditioners to the mind. They cause different states of mind. And so in this example of this monk giving the talk, maybe he has the perception, even feeling maybe that, oh, giving a talk is going to be, it's very stressful. I want to really give a good talk. I really want to, share the Dhamma. I in creating a sense of self of it as well, of I want to be the one who's, giving this talk, or it's all on me to give this good, impression, and there's people who are all listening to me. So that creates that sort of, state of mind where maybe then it's stressed, or they say these days there's a fear of public speaking, these sort of things. And so from that, the what conditions speech is the thoughts. So the thoughts of, you have that chatter in your mind of your thinking what to say. That's the thing that conditions our speech. And so in this case, the monk, I could say that his mind would be completely empty, because I've had that experience myself when I first gave a Dhamma talk. Could talk for about maybe 10 minutes, and then the mind completely blank. And I was like, oh, so peaceful now. and had nothing to say, basically. And so that's these thoughts condition this speech. And the body, you could say, after that sort of 2 minutes of, or during that 2 minutes of pausing, he's just being mindful of his breath, trying to calm down, and then finally able to think again and to speak. So this is, these perceptions and feelings are something we can start being aware of, being mindful of, and even changing and using it for our benefit. And so the first perception is developing a perception of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And we're all very fortunate here to have great faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, that we can come and we're really devoting ourselves to the practice. And there was one, you could say, man in the time of the Buddha who, they said he was a leper, so very, they said very wretched. Yes, leper means his skin disease, and very poor, probably living on the streets. And he saw a huge crowd gathering together. And from that, he was thinking, oh, are they giving out food or something for free? So he went there to have a look. And there he saw that the people were coming to listen to the Dhamma of the Buddha. And so then he thought himself then, oh, I should also listen. I should also have intent to listen to the Dhamma. And so he did that. And when he listened to the Dhamma with great intent, then he could put his mind, you say, on the current of the Dhamma, and was able to have his mind ripe, prepared, ready to receive the Dhamma, and he could attain to Sotapanna. So he saw, developed the insight that whatever is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease. And so gaining that firm faith in Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But after this, it's said that Sakka, the king of the Devas, came to him and wanted to test him, and tested him by asking him, I'm going to give you're a very poor person, you're very wretched, I'm going to give you all this money, but all you have to do is to throw away the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And obviously the man refused to do this, as in that be something he'd never do. And so so Sakka then relays this to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, well, even 100 of you, Sakka, or 1,000 of you wouldn't be enough to make this man give away his refuge of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And so this is a kind of recollection or a perception even that we can have and develop, that we have this great faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the Buddha who has arisen in this world, which is such a very rare thing to happen, and that we're fortunate enough to be in time for this sasana, this dispensation of the Buddha. We're so fortunate to have the Dhamma, the teachings that we can lead us to the end of suffering, to Nibbana, still in this present day. And we're very fortunate to have these, the Sangha, the noble teachers who have seen the truth for themselves, and in this present day is guiding us and helping us to progress, to develop, develop this path to this ending of suffering. So having that wealth, then it's kind of like we have this wealth in our hearts that we'd never feel poor or wretched or lacking in anything. And so then in every situation, then we're like very wealthy, we're very rich or very complete. And so we can carry that sort of feeling and that perception onwards into our practice and develop it. And it's not that once we have this sort of refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha that everything then starts to turn our way and we become wealthy and rich and we have no bad experiences. It's not like that. But instead, we have this refuge for us to maybe look or to take everything as part of the practice, as a part of a way that we're going to develop our insight or insight into the truth. And so before, when I was a young monk in Wat Mapchan, I remember that I was very sort of determined in the practice there, and I was thinking, you know, I just have to be very mindful in the, you know, present moment, and I'll try to cut off the exterior things as much as I can. And so back then I had to, my maybe eyesight was getting not so good, so I had to wear glasses. But I thought, oh, forget about these glasses. I don't really need to see much at all. You know, I'm just going to keep it within, keep the my mindfulness within, but is much better. Why see so clearly anyway? And so I'm just doing this, not using glasses. And then one day after the evening drink, it was starting to get dark, but not dark enough where maybe you really need a torch. So I was walking back to my kuti in the forest, and there's a stick there on the path, and I step over it. But just as I'm stepping over it, I look down and realize that, oh no, this is not a stick. This is a pit viper. And by then it's kind of too late looking down, and the snake is already getting up to into the striking position, and I only can jump with my back foot over it. And so as I jump off over it, then I see the it strike and just miss my left foot. And I don't know how it didn't hit me or strike me or bite me, but I got out of that situation, went back to my kuti like this. But from then on, I had a kind of like a big phobia even of snakes, as in anywhere going in the forest, any stick for me was like, oh, that's for sure a snake, or I'll try to avoid it as best I can. And this was is kind of a fear even, or always coming up on my mind, and disliking snakes obviously. And so then a day, one of those days after it, in the going to the evening chanting in the Uposatha hall, and then Venerable Ajahn Anand comes up with his attendant monk, and the attendant monk's carrying this wooden fake snake. And he puts it up almost to my face like this. For some reason, he thought he wanted to do that. It's a snake which kind of goes left and right, the wooden ones, maybe you've seen it. And so he does that to me, and I reel back, going, oh, you know, I don't like that at all. As if, you know, I mean, it's just a fake snake. But then Ajahn Anand straight away says, oh, contemplate sanya, that's sanya, perception. And so after that, contemplated into sanya perception, that because of that incident of stepping over that snake or jumping over it, and that's a kind of painful feeling, you could say, painful experience, and that shapes the perception in that way. And so now everything, sort of any stick seeing, oh, that's a snake, or if I can avoid this forest or go this way, then I would do that. And this sort of fear coming up was basically a fear of, you could say, this thing outside is threatening sort of your self view or my self view. You know, it's something that can maybe, you know, harm you or kill you or hurt you. And then the tendency from that perception is to have bad thoughts, unskillful thoughts, ill will, even hatred. If one doesn't have any sort of sila, precepts, morality, then one maybe will kill, will harm. And so the practice then was to be aware of that perception, and then to develop mindfulness with it, and to develop goodwill, thinking, you know, may they be well, may they be well. The snakes also want safety. They're also fearful as well. And that's why they're doing it like that. They're trying to protect themselves just in the same way that we want to protect ourselves. And remembering one of the stories from Venerable Ajahn Chah giving inspiration that when he was practicing on Tudong deep in the forest, that there would be these wild dogs coming to his glot, which is that umbrella mosquito net. And so the mosquito net obviously gives no protection, but a whole group of wild dogs had come around there and even starting to try to bite into there. And the fear came up because they're that close and being, I guess, scared of being harmed, scared of death. But he made an aspiration or a vow that I've come here to practice. I've come here to seek the end of suffering. If I haven't done any harm to you, then may you not harm me, may you leave me alone. But if I have harmed you in the past, then may you harm me back. May you, take the, I think in there it said, may you kill me. So it was that sort of firm. You say, if I've not done nothing wrong to you, then nothing wrong will come back to me. And then that's sort of the end of it, you could say. And so developing that perception. And there was one other senior monk in this branch monastery of Wat Mapchan, and he's known for his very good meditation. I remember he'd show like he there's a there was once this snake walking past, and I'm sorry, walking, crawling past the around the hall, and I just happened to be there. It's like, oh, don't like that. And then this monk, he gets down right next to the snake and goes, "Hey, hey, look, look," and then starts to spread metta right to the snake. Right next to it, and it's like, and it the snake's not sort of what do you call it sort of aggressive or anything at all. He's showing, oh, that's the power of metta one can develop as well. And so that having that perception of metta is of like there's no there's, sorry, there's a feeling of not having any feeling of harm for anyone, any creature, anywhere. That's sort of what we're trying to develop. So yeah, developing that perception of perception of metta, of goodwill, and having mindfulness to that perception was what I was taught to contemplate. And that is part of the practice as well. I said if whenever this anger or hatred or dosa, ill will comes up, then that works to harm ourself, to harm others, or to harm both, and it leads to suffering. And to abandon that dosa, that ill will, that hatred, that cruelty, that is like a cessation, or it's a temporary nibbana, or you can say it's nibbana that is able to be realized in the here and now. It may not be full nibbana, but it's a nibbana of being able to abandon that dosa, that defilement, that hatred, the ill will. And so that is sort of developing in the practice. And someone came recently and they said that they had heard from a Dhamma talk from another teacher, and this teacher apparently taught them, oh, the Nibbana is like going into the being in a desert and being very, very thirsty, having no water there, and then someone gives you this cold Coke. And then it quenches your thirst like that. And they said, oh, that's Nibbana. And so he told me this, and I thought, I don't know about that teaching, if that's really Nibbana or not. I'm pretty sure Nibbana is the abandoning of the thirst, the desire completely. And so I told him this story of my own story of, you could say, having a Coke, which was when I was in Thailand and going on Tudong, so walking around the north of Thailand. And Tudong here is is kind of a maybe austere or ascetic practice in the way that it brings you a lot of suffering, a lot of physical suffering. Like you're carrying all your stuff, it's very heavy. You have to walk. Usually you're walking to different places. So it's very hot, sweaty. You're taking everything you need in your robes, and then only eating that one meal, which you get from alms round, eating in that one sitting, and then continue on to walk. And so bringing up this physical suffering is good for the practice, you could say. And so I was doing this in the north of Thailand, and I was walking, and it was, kind of suffering, but trying to keep your practice, butoh butoh. And then get to this convenience store, mom and pop store, a convenience store. And this lady comes out and says, "Oh, Venerable, can I offer you a cold drink?" And then I said, "Yeah, sure. Why not? Very tired, exhausted already." And so then she offers a cold Coke. So I drink this Coke, and it's oh, so refreshing, so refreshing. And so after that, had that and continued on. And then the next day is the same after the meal and everything. It's very hot, very sort of sweaty, tiring. And then in the corner of my eye, I see another convenience store. And then maybe someone will come and out and offer another Coke. And so maybe crossing the road there first, or maybe walking a bit slower, making sure they can kind of see the monk walking past, make sure they have a chance to make some merit, kind of thing. All these sort of thoughts coming up like that. Or maybe, oh, maybe if I've whatever merit I've made, maybe someone will, good karma will come up, result. And then passing by, and then no one coming out, walking past. And you know what state that is? Suffering. And then on reflecting on that, it's like, where's the suffering come up? Does the suffering only come up when you pass the store and no one comes out to give you? And you remember being a monk, then a forest monk, then we don't hold money as well, so you can't just go in and oh, no, I'll just buy it myself. Where does the suffering come up? So you could say, yeah, when they didn't offer you keep walking past, then that's when you suffer. But actually, it happens even before that, which is when your eye sees that form and has this perception, where the perception from the day before, where someone had given you something really good, it was a very pleasant feeling. When you see that, then that feeling comes up, the perception comes up. Oh, this maybe someone can do that again. And you could say that desire or expectation had already come up right there. And so from there, you have to try to fulfill that desire, that expectation, even to satisfy that craving. So that's the cause of suffering right there. But if you look at it, then even the day before, when someone comes and offers a Coke, and then you kind of enjoy it, enjoy the pleasant feeling, and don't have mindfulness with it, don't reflect on it, that's already bringing up the cause of suffering. And the simile is what like Ajahn Chah gives is the snake with the head is like the suffering, the poison in the head, that's the suffering. But the tail as well is like the happiness. If you grab the tail, which is the happiness, then the head, which is the suffering, comes back around and bites you all the same. So you think you're smart by just grabbing the tail, but in the end, it just comes back around and you suffer. And so the idea is to know this and to step around it, to go around it, to be very, very careful, which is the mindfulness there. And so the the next day, then having to practice with it is, you know, if you see the store, the perception comes up, it's being trying to be very mindful, then instead of maybe crossing the road, etc., just, you know, butoh butoh, and keep the mind away from this sort of liking or disliking, and to even walk faster even. And so this is like kind of the training that is maybe necessary to abandon that desire. That's the training or the practice. And that's like, you could say Nibbana is a abandoning of that desire, the craving there, to abandon that greed, that wanting. Then that's coolness, that's peacefulness. There's no more wanting then after that. So yeah, training in that way, then that was, you can see how maybe these sensual pleasures then can be dangerous in that way, or painful in that way. And many of you in the monastery, you know, you may not experience a tudong like that or whatnot, but there's plenty of ways that the mind starts to delight. And probably one of the main ways is during the meal. I don't know how many of you in the monastery there, but I heard there's about 80 or so. And so, you know, probably the meal, you likely have the main meal, you where the food table's there. And you know, how is it that you know which food you want to take? As in, you know, generally people are going to go in the line and take whatever food they like. The one they don't like, they won't take. How do you know which one is good,
I
which one
didn't
is
get
not,
that. Could you try
which one's
again?
not? And say, oh, that's from this sort of, in the past, you've had this, you know, pleasant taste, these good tastes, and then you create this perception of what's good. And the next time you go around, you want that food, then you choose that one. And then the one that you maybe tasted doesn't taste very good, it's got this sort of painful feeling, oh, then that one. You develop a perception and you don't take that. So Venerable Ajahn Anand says to practice with food. So his teaching is the food that you like, take less of that. The food that you dislike, then take more of that. And so that's the training. Or he says, oh, you can notice yourself when you're going, before you take the food there. And then you take it. If you think I've taken not enough, then it's enough. It'll be enough in the end. If you take enough that you think is, oh, this is enough for me, then you've taken too much. As in, you'll find at the end, oh, you've taken too much. You have left over. And so it's kind of the craving there coming in like that. And so even with food, you can notice as well. And just remembering another teaching Venerable Ajahn Anand would give the monks is, he's saying, oh, if you are going to say something to another monk, for instance, you know, if it's something that is even maybe a bit critical or whatnot, he said, don't say it before the meal. At least wait for after. He said, why? Is because if you haven't eaten for, you know, 24 hours, then there's a hunger there. With that hunger, that is like a unpleasant feeling, like suffering. A hunger is the greatest suffering, it said. And so you don't have, you're sort of hungry, then that's going to shape your mind states. So if someone says something like that, oh, you may get angry a lot more easier, or irritated a lot more easier. So that having mindfulness with that, or you would say after the meal, then be careful of talking too much, chatting and being really rowdy kind of. And why is that? Is because after you've sort of eaten everything you like, and you know, the body's very full, and you can notice when you're eating as well that it's kind of a lot of thoughts there. It's hard to get the mind to be peaceful then when you're eating everything you like. It's why you're bringing mindfulness to that. If you take everything you like, you can try. Can you count how many mouthfuls that you take, that as in how many mouthfuls till you finish eating. You say, oh, maybe one, two, three, and it's gone like that. And then it's thinking all over the place. And that actually just carries on for after when you've finished eating, the same thing. And then with all these thoughts, like I said in the beginning, all these thoughts leads you to break out into speech. And that's why it's kind of the more thoughts there are, the more probably you're going to speak. And that's why then Ajahn Anand teaching, or be mindful of that as well. So practice this. You can bring up a perception of maybe the unattractive nature of the food, or the perception of even the foulness of the food. One monk, he pointed out that, oh, when the food goes in and you sort of swallow it up and it's sort of mushed up in your stomach, he's like, that sort of mushed up food, which is kind of like vomit, that's what's making you feel so good. They're giving you that pleasant feeling. But if you took it out, you looked at it, that pleasant feeling would be gone, And that's kind of, you're developing this perception to make sure you're sort of maybe stabilizing the mind more, to keep it more away from this liking and disliking, and to, you could say, reduce that craving for taste. And if you can do this, then the mind's starting to be more peaceful, or the practice is coming more into, even your eating, your daily life as well. On the other hand, it's like, oh, people these days, maybe they just, maybe talk when they're eating and things like that, or watch other, entertainment, then they have no mindfulness whatsoever with that sort of eating. So I guess, yeah, in the monastery, you can practice that as well. But this actually applies to pretty much all sort of sensual pleasures as well. One reflection I had is, sensual pleasures is kind of, why do people get caught in sensual pleasures? We have in the monastery a lot that people will come and kind of, they kind of come after their suffering, right? When they're happy in it, maybe you don't see them come to the monastery, but when they're suffering, then you come. Like, I think today someone had the dog pass away, suffering a lot, so she came to the monastery. But wondering, where does this, where, you know, why is this, where does this suffering kind of come from? Like, they didn't intend to suffer, you didn't choose to suffer, right? In the first place, then how come now you are? Or people get into relationships and then after, they can't stand each other after like 10 years, or why is that? In the beginning, you could, the more time you spent together, the better. But after 10 years, and I think someone said the other day when they were here, they said, oh, even now, just spending, I don't know, 24 minutes, not 24/7, 24 minutes already is a lot of suffering, very, very difficult. And so contemplating that these sense experiences or sense pleasures are like honey, the sweet honey on a blade, a razor blade. So one simile of it. So in other words, like you're trying to taste or lick the sweet honey off the razor blade, and then end up sort of cutting yourself on there and saying, oh, why did I get cut on there? Why me? It's like that. And, or blaming this, or because of them, because of, this other person, or that, why, it's not my fault. But we're trying to develop mindfulness to see more clearly into this. The more clearer we can see into this, the less harm it's going to do ourself. As in, if you only see the honey, then definitely you're going to get cut very deeply by the razor blade. But if you knew there is that sort of drawback, the danger, then you're more likely to be a lot more careful, a lot more mindful. Then you have a sort of chance at maybe seeing the drawbacks of it. So developing this perception of being there being drawbacks of sense experiences is an important perception we need to develop. And it's kind of like a perception of seeing the suffering in impermanence. This means like If we say everything is impermanent, then I mean, we should know all this body is impermanent, all the things around me are impermanent, but we also need to see the suffering in impermanence. If we see the suffering in impermanence, then it's like we see the why impermanence is kind of bad, or why it's suffering, why it's a drawback, why it's a danger. And this is meant to give us a lot more inspiration in the practice, more effort. We won't be lazy or careless if we can see this. And this is kind of where I started, or why I ordained even. Before I ordained, I was 25. I could say I had pretty much everything. I felt like came from a sort of quite good family, wealthy, had my own apartment, own sports car, or had a relationship, working already as a manager in a business. So everything was going well, and you'd think, oh, then that's good, keep going. But in sort of, you could say, after maybe meditation or seeing more clearly, I could see the suffering in that, the suffering in that, that has to change. It's not going to last like that forever. It will go up and it will go down for sure. There's no other way. And then that, you would say, insight even, or perception, or seeing that suffering more clearly, then you could say made me want to give, abandon that, renounce that, seeing that sort of being dispassionate in those things, then wanting to relinquish them away because they are impermanent. They end up having no meaning. This body eventually must die for sure. And this brings up this heedfulness, wanting to seek something higher than that, this maybe effort, you could say, in practice. And from that, I was able to renounce all those things and go ordain in Thailand, in Wat Mapchan. If I didn't have that, I don't think I could have ordained even, sort of having everything and then seeing that actually it must pass away one day. And yeah, you will hear this in probably many of the talks that Venerable Ajahn Anand gives, always talking about impermanence, of the body, of things, or the breath. Everything's just in this breath. If this breath goes and everything's gone, it's like that. So impermanent, so unstable, so unsatisfactory, even if you want to call dukkha unsatisfactory. So seeing that as a perception, and this is something you can develop, or you should develop, by seeing sort of this danger of in things that are impermanent. And one way to develop this is a sutta that I like a lot, and that is, so you can bring up this perception. And the sutta is that the Buddha says, imagine then on one side there's this the most beautiful woman in the world on one side. On the other side, then a big crowd gathers, and then this beautiful woman starts to sing and dance, and then this huge crowd comes and goes, oh, look, this. There's this most beautiful woman in the world, and she's singing and dancing. So gathered there, and then you or a person then has to walk in between the most beautiful woman in the world and this huge crowd, and they put a pot of oil on top of your head, and says, okay, you who value your life, you have to walk in between here. And this man with a drawn sword will walk behind you. And if you drop even one drop of oil, then this man will chop your head off. And the Buddha gives this simile of how one develops mindfulness of the body. It's in its, you think that man would be able to think here and there, like kind of, oh, you know, I'll think of this or look right or look left. No, they're going to be very mindful, developing and training themselves in that way that they can sustain their mindfulness on the body. And the body here can mean, you know, the breath, the postures, the walking meditation. I like to do that when the walking meditation, because you're walking on a path already, but you're trying to develop this sort of heedfulness, this mindfulness, and that sort of cuts away any laziness and carelessness in the practice. So you can try to develop mindfulness like that, imagining that if that helps you. The other useful perception is this perception of not self in suffering, not self in suffering, because we will have suffering arise, and you can kind of notice what happens when suffering arises is that you say, why me? There's this self that sort of comes up, and it's me suffering, and the way to overcome it is seeing the not self in that suffering. So I remember once when I was going alms round in Thailand, and I was leading the, I think it's two other monks, and we were walking in the market, which you get a lot of food, and it's always in bags. And so the first monk will receive all the bags because the person will give it to the first monk. And then the usual practice is that then the second monk, the one behind, will help to carry it and then pass it down, and they're sort of separated equally, so it's not too heavy for the first monk because he has to always receive the food, the food, the bags. And so walking like that, receiving the food, and I'm expecting the second monk to take it from me, and he doesn't. He just, as if very equanimous, not very indifferent to it. And so I thought, never mind, you know, take the second bag, the third bag, fourth bag. Still doesn't take anything. And then I'm thinking, oh, so heavy, how can I carry all this myself? You know, why doesn't this monk help me at all? What's he, you know, what's he doing? Is he trying to pretend or whatnot? And then the mind starts to proliferate in all sorts of things like that. And then realize, no, I have to, you know, practice with this, you know, abandon this sort of ill will there, and decide, or firmly decide that, oh, never mind, no matter how much it is, I'll just carry all of it. You know, I don't need anyone to help. And as soon as I kind of made that maybe decision or vow or whatnot, the look down, and it's actually was a lot of bags, but it's actually not that heavy at all. You know, so this is when you make a sense of self out of the suffering, it becomes much, much more heavy. The, when you can take out that sort of self out of it, then it's not that bad. It's simply arising from causes, or it's only maybe a physical suffering there. It's not a mental suffering there. And so the Buddha says developing this perception of the not self in suffering is what is going to cut off the I making and my making. So we probably heard this from other talks of how we keep creating an I and a my because we make it, we create it. And so to develop the perception of there not being a self in there, then it's just coming from causes and conditions, then we are able to at least start to reduce that suffering. At least when suffering arises, we don't kind of look outside, we kind of look in. You know, then we're trying, then I think it's Nupo Sumedho's teaching that whenever after, as he said, after 40, 50 years as a monk, now every time he suffers, he'll always bring it in to look for the cause like that. And so that's a practice that we have to develop as well. Whenever we have suffering, we bring it in to find the cause. The cause is never outside, it's always inside. That desire, the attachment, that clinging, the craving, why me, all this, we abandon that, and then the suffering then will end, rather than trying to solve the suffering by solving it outside, changing the conditions outside, changing that person, this person, that's never going to do it completely. And so we can practice in that way. And this suffering in the body, we have to see it more clearly. And you could say suffering in the body, maybe it's hard to see. We hold this body as me, like so firmly. And so how do we contemplate it or see the suffering more in it? There was a young monk who came to Venerable Ajahnanan and asked him, "Oh, how do we practice? Because it's hard to see the suffering in the body." And Venerable Ajahnanan, he said, "Oh, that's normal because you're still young, so you don't. It's not easy then to see suffering." So he said, "If you have wisdom, you will be able to see that suffering. But if you don't, you can try sitting, as in sitting meditation, for a long time, like that, as in that will bring up these feelings or even painful feelings that will help you to be able to see the suffering in the body or help you be able to contemplate that." And you can try that practice as well, or at least when the painful feelings come up, not to push it away all the time, but to start to bring more mindfulness and awareness to it, taking out the self out of that, or I'm in pain, or this body is in pain. But the feeling is one thing, the body is another thing, the mind is another thing. So developing that mindfulness with it. So today talked a bit about your perception and feeling, just to give an object for our contemplation, that it's these feelings, painful feelings, the pleasant feelings, that are going to shape our perceptions, whether it's a positive perception, negative one. And from here, then this leads us, or it affects our mind, and it leads to different sort of thoughts, whether it's unwholesome, unskillful thoughts, or if they're free of those things, and it's wholesome thoughts come up. But this leads us to develop all sorts of defilements, or the ill will, the greed can come up from our perceptions, a delusion. So if we have more mindfulness with it, then we can start to be more aware and not let those feelings or perceptions lead to desire, to craving, to making a me, a my out of it. And the more clearly we can see things, then the more likely, you could say, wisdom will arise, or will gain more understanding into the Dhamma.